Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do we play ball anyway? That was 7-year-old Aiden Fox's question to his dad a couple of years ago during a backyard game of catch. And as an anthropologist, John Fox was uniquely qualified to take up the question, reaching deep into our evolutionary history and traveling all over the world to find what turned out to be some very complex answers. The result of all that work is John Fox's new book, The Ball, Discovering the Object of the Game. John, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be on the program.
It is remarkable how the very simplest questions are the ones that yield the most interesting, complicated answers. What did you initially tell your son?
It was one of those questions that kind of caught me a little flat-footed, as you can imagine. Being in the middle of playing a game and having this existential question thrown your way. The funny thing is the game just resumed. There was this kind of quiet recognition that the answer was more involved than we could get into. And luckily, 7-year-olds move on to the next thing pretty easily.
But their dads don't, because you stayed obsessed.
I did stay obsessed. For me, as you said, it was one of these simple questions that is also profound, and it kind of reverberated for me. And I had spent most of my graduate career as an anthropologist studying ball games, particularly the games of the ancient Maya and the Aztec in Central America. So I was kind of prepared to go deep on this question, and I think Aiden kind of teed it up for me in a way that allowed me to pursue a complex problem and question, but in a playful, kind of childlike way.
When and why does it seem likely that humans started playing with balls of some kind in the first place?
Well, when you get back before the historical record, obviously you get into the realm of some theorization and speculation. But it's pretty easy to imagine that our earliest ancestors would have been using stone tools going back, several hundred thousand years and even a million years in Africa. And we find stone tools that are used for example, hammering other objects or making stone tools, these things called hammer stones. And over time, when they're used, they become spherical, they become round. And it's easy to imagine that it wouldn't have taken much for our earliest ancestors to recognize that these objects rolled in interesting ways and had a certain kind of movement and quality that other objects didn't have, and from there that might have evolved into actually fabricating these spheres and figuring out ways to play with them, ways to enjoy them. But the earliest actual historical evidence comes from ancient Mesopotamia and Egypt around 1500 BC.
And a lot of the skills that we have to use in playing sports that involve balls are not so different from what we would use to hunt.
That's right. If you took the standard Paleolithic hunter's toolkit of a throwing stone, a spear, and a net, you could pretty much open a sporting goods store with the basics. And the basic skill set of a hunter-gatherer is really the ability to chase down prey, the strategy of using several hunters to cover territory evenly. Obviously, the physical dexterity, the ability to throw objects with precision. I mean, when you piece those things together, again, you have something approximating modern sport.
And there's also this link with intelligence and with the formation of human societies, because in order to play a sport, even if you're competing really fiercely, everybody has to agree on the rules.
That's right. It's the interesting thing about most sports, when you think about them, is there's a sort of interesting, delicate balance between collaboration and competition. Particularly when it involves balls, it's a social activity. It involves people who are on the same team or same side, interacting very closely, linking their minds and connecting their sort of physical abilities to achieve goals together. And it also, even with our competitors, requires a sort of understanding of these things called rules. Without the idea of rules, sports don't mean much. If everybody just started throwing balls randomly with no limits, you wouldn't have anything like we think of modern sports.
It's like a playground in a preschool, basically.
Exactly, with chimpanzees, maybe.
Let's talk about that, because the animals, it turns out, that we believe to be, based on modern science, the most intelligent, are also some of the most likely to play.
Absolutely. Anybody who has a dog and likes to play with their dog knows that dogs are incredibly playful animals, and we don't need to teach them how to play. They kind of come already doing it. And many mammals are like that. I spent a wonderful time, which I cover in the book, with my daughter, actually, studying dolphins in Florida. And a scientist down there is looking at how dolphins play and how play is an integral part of their survival as a species and how young dolphins learn to navigate the world around them. Breaking through this notion that play is something frivolous and purposeless, and getting to this realization that it's actually something really critical to survival and human and animal development.
And do adult dolphins teach their young sort of rules of the games?
They do in interesting ways. This scientist, Stan Kushai, who I studied with, has observed games played between a parent and a younger dolphin where the parent is essentially kind of goading the younger dolphin to recognize the rules of play, and the younger dolphin is mimicking the adult, but it's not an activity that has an immediate purpose. In other words, they're not pursuing fish and food. They're clearly playing. They're clearly enjoying it, but they're also learning in the process.
Is there a relationship between spatial relation skills and participation in sports that involve balls?
Absolutely. You know, the fascinating thing about balls, and probably one of the reasons that they have captured our imaginations for so long, is that they have these interesting qualities. I mean, they are inanimate, and yet they can take on this amazing sense of animation, bouncing and ricocheting, sometimes in predictable ways, sometimes with a spin in very unpredictable ways. So they certainly work on the brain in a particular way, and there's evidence to suggest that these games, these spatial skills and these games actually help to shape our cognition, particularly when we're young. Building not only our physical ability, but also our sort of mental agility at the same time.
It's interesting that in the movie Castaway, you remember with Tom Hanks, he becomes really attached to this ball, this volleyball that he's come to think of as almost a companion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think, you know, I've been going around talking about my book, and in every audience I talk to, people come up with the most kind of moving stories about their favorite ball, you know, a toy that they had when they were a kid that they would bring everywhere with them. Or even today, even people in their offices who, you know, sit at their desk while they're thinking and bounce a ball off the wall because it helps them to get into a certain zone and a certain way of thinking. There's an attachment there that is universal, and it's that attachment that really captured my imagination.
And it's funny because people who are not really into sports sometimes, you know, roll their eyes when they see people getting so worked up for games. But you write about the Maya, for example, and their game of Ulama, and it really was for them a life and death business.
Yes, the first thing to know about the Maya and the Aztecs and the other people of what's known as Mesoamerica, so Mexico and Central America, is that they invented rubber. So rubber trees were indigenous to the lowlands there, and they were the first people anywhere in the world to figure out how to produce rubber and then how to produce these incredible rubber balls, solid rubber balls that they played with. So they played a game that stretches back now almost 3,000 years, which is usually called Ulama. And Ulama involved bouncing this ball back and forth, trying to pass it through a high stone ring within a sometimes very elaborate ball court and stadium. But in many of these games, the loser, we believe it was the loser, was sacrificed, meaning ritually sacrificed. And this was part of a kind of grand ceremony. So for them, this game was at times far more than a game. It was a a ritual that was used to kind of propagate fertility and continue the cosmos and keep the sun and the moon moving in the sky. It was a really important ceremony for those people.
Do we know anything about how they trained for these competitions?
We know a little bit. When the Spanish arrived in what's now Mexico City, Tenochtitlan was the capital of the Aztec Empire in the 15th century. They actually observed these games going on, and you know, to their eyes, they called it tennis because back in Europe they were playing a game of the ball called tennis.
Mm-hmm.
And so they described the games, and they talked about how the best ball players were oftentimes kind of kept and managed by some of the elite in the city, and that they were then played against one another, and that there was gambling around these games, sometimes quite elaborate gambling. So in some ways, you know, in some ways incredibly exotic and different than our games, and in other ways incredibly similar.
Even the fact that during these games of Ulama, there were, I guess, musicians on the sidelines and cheering crowds, it doesn't sound so different from any major league sporting event today.
No, really similar. I enjoy showing slides of these games side by side because I think we enjoy exoticizing these things in the distant past and in other cultures. I see it as part of my job as an anthropologist to take those things that we think are exotic and make them familiar. The Maya, when they played these games, as you said, they played music, so we see pictures of these games with musicians all around. We see people wearing elaborate costumes. Have you ever been to, you know, a Cowboys game or a football game? People painted all colors and with their shirts off and, you know, all kinds of craziness. The Maya did that too. They feasted. So I actually excavated ball courts down there where you find the remains of drinking vessels, where, lo and behold, they were drinking alcoholic beverages and having a great time. So, you know, you keep adding these things up, and yes, you get this idea that people are people and that sports, in some ways, are sports across time.
They even found ways millennia before electric lights were invented to play at night.
Yeah, well, they obviously they had torches. They used pitch from pine-like what they call copal, and they had torches all around the courts. I mean, these were incredible affairs. If you go down to those parts today and you see the remains of these stadiums, they were quite something. They were beautifully crafted from stone with sculptures all around them. They were usually right next to the temple and the other important buildings. So these were, much like our stadiums, part of the civic structure of society, and then they had this ritual component, and on top of that, the actual sport itself is really pretty impressive.
And playing with a flaming ball seems like a bad idea, but I guess it was exciting technology at the time.
Yeah, you know, I guess when the ultimate stakes are human sacrifice, you know, getting burned by a flaming ball is such a big deal.
John Fox is my guest. He's an anthropologist and author of the new book, The Ball, Discovering the Object of the Game. We'll talk more about this in a couple of minutes and invite you to join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with anthropologist John Fox. He's author of the new book, The Ball, Discovering the Object of the Game. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. How closely related, John, is the American game of football to its European ancestor?
It is surprisingly close. So the origins of football go way back to the 12th century in England. And at that time, there was a game played across England and France that was usually called mob football. And in France, it was called Le Soule. And this game involved one side of town kind of battling against the other side of town, or one parish against another, with hundreds of people involved. It was kind of a huge scrum, and that over time kind of broke out into little clusters of games in different parts of England, different parts of Europe. Some of them that evolved into what we think of as rugby, where you could actually hold and carry the ball. Others into what we think of as soccer, where obviously is really a game played with the foot. In America, things weren't that different for most of that time period. There were a lot of different regional games played. But actually in New England and around the Boston area, there was a version of the game that was played that involved tackling and running with the ball. And it was that version of the game that was picked up by Harvard University and eventually became America's game and really kind of outshone these other games, and particularly soccer.
What did John Heisman have to do with the shape of the ball that we have today?
Well, Heisman has a wonderful speech that he gave to his players where he talked about, at that time, the shape of the ball, which was pretty close to the modern shape that we have today in size. He described it as a prolate spheroid, which is the technical term for that particular kind of interesting oblong shape. And he gave a speech basically describing the physical properties of this ball, the prolate spheroid, as if he were giving a physics lesson. And then he ended with saying, you know, basically, don't drop this ball. This ball is too important to drop. And but he was very he had a connection to the ball because in that time period was when the forward pass was really emerging in the game. And up till that time, it was really a running game and not a throwing game. And it was when it became a game focused more on passing that the ball took on that sort of bullet shape that it has today and had a reason to take on that shape.
And we call it a pig skin because originally footballs were made with a pig bladder. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, over time in history, balls have been made of all kinds of things. Basically, whatever cultures had available. You know, the Eskimos played with seal skin balls. In Africa, they had balls made of hippo hide. and across most of Europe, there was pig's bladders. So, you know, right up until the mid 1800s. They were playing with balls that essentially were a pig's bladder on the inside and then encased with a rough leather casing. And it would lose air, and they'd have to, you know, pump it back full of air constantly in the middle of games. And it was really with the vulcanization of rubber in the 1840s with Charles Goodyear that, you know, the pigskin was replaced with rubber. But that term pigskin stayed with the game of football. Unfortunately, footballs today are really made of cow skin. It doesn't have much to do with pigs anymore.
But they are pretty much made, at least any kind of NFL balls, are all made in the same factory in Ohio that they've been made in for half a century.
Yes, it's really wonderful. It's a wonderful thing. You know, we think of football, American football, as this, you know, really incredibly advanced game, both in terms of strategy and technology and, you know, the sort of digital display of how we watch the game. But the ball itself is really kind of simple. I went to the small town of Ada, Ohio, and that's where they've made every football since 1955, played in the NFL. And it's an assembly line. It's a really simple process of taking cowhide and turning it into these, you know, highly regular and consistent high-performance balls with about 150 workers. So it's great to see that the technology in some ways hasn't changed dramatically around the ball, even if so much around the game itself has changed.
So we think about football, incorrectly, it turns out, as this quintessentially American sport. On the other hand, we have this other fancy prep school sport with a fancy French name that turns out to be the quintessential American game.
This would be, are you talking about jeu de paume? Or
lacrosse.
Which one?
Lacrosse.
Oh, lacrosse. Yes, lacrosse. Lacrosse, which is now this elite prep school game, really got its start with the Native American peoples of New York, New England, going all the way to the Great Plains. And lacrosse has this deep meaning for the people who originated the game. They call it the creator's game. And I got to spend some time with some of the Native American peoples that still play the game in some of the traditional ways up in the Iroquois territory of northern New York, and they play a version of the game on ceremonies that they call medicine games, and these medicine games still have a lot of the symbolism and a lot of the kind of cultural roots of the game as it was played back in the 14 and 1500s.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Bob in DeSoto. Hi, Bob.
Hi. This is a very interesting program, and while I was listening, I just happened to think from what I know about reading and studying the Bible, I don't know of any mention in the Bible of any games like, you know, with balls or anything like that, and I wondered if the author either knew of any that mentioned in the Bible, or if he understood, if he knew about games that were played during the biblical times.
That's a great question, Bob. I don't know in great detail about what's covered in the Bible. I do know that the word ball does appear in the Bible, or at least the equivalent of it. So they were aware of ball games across that part of the world in that time period. There were ball games being played in the Near East by the Sumerian people in what's now modern-day Iraq, going back 2500 BC, and then spreading from there into Egypt. I think it's highly likely that in the biblical lands and in the biblical period that ball games were part of the culture, even if they didn't rise to the category of something that would be discussed in the Bible. I think they were very much part of everyday life.
So tennis has already come up a few times in this conversation, and we call it the sport of kings. But before it could be the sport of kings, it was the sport of monks?
Yes, very unexpectedly. tennis is as old as football. It dates to around the 12th century in France. And the early origins of the game were within the monasteries in rural France and these cloisters where, you know, monks had time to kill between penance and fasting and other such activities. They had to have some fun. And they played this game that was called jeu de paume, which means the game played with the palm of the hand. And they played within the courtyard, the cloister walls. And there's wonderful depictions of these monks playing this this innocent game. Over time, of course, the princes and the sort of young royalty were being educated in these monasteries, and so they took on this game and said, "Wow, this is a great game." And within a short period of time, it became all the rage on the royal circuit. So kings and royalty were building their own tennis courts, which mirrored the features of these monastic cloisters. And then over time, they added the net and they added the racket, and it evolved into what we think of as tennis.
It's funny to think that the racket initially was very controversial, and it was thought of as sort of a handicap. In other words, it would help people who were not so good at the game, and it was really, the racket was for wimps.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good way to put it. It was seen as kind of cheating. It was this new invention. It started as kind of a paddle without strings, and but it, because it was a handball game, people looked askance at it and said, "Well, you know, it's a far more elegant game played with the hand." But then this notion, you know, which was part of that era and part of that culture, was that, well, if there's a racket involved, then, you know, one doesn't have to exert oneself so much and risk sweating. And so it became this elite thing to own and have a racket and to not exert yourself so much with your hand, but to use this newfangled thing called a racket. And, you know, it's funny to think back on that now because, of course, we can't even imagine tennis or, you know, a Federer and Nadal match with hands.
Or with no sweating, for that matter.
Exactly.
So the evolution of the tennis ball is really an amazing part of this story. It started out that they were using beard trimmings to stuff those balls?
Yes, beard trimmings, of which there were plenty in old Paris, apparently. There's actually several mentions in Shakespeare's plays of tennis. It was because it was such a popular sport of that era, and some wonderful quotes about beard hair being used to stuff tennis balls. There was a lot of different things used to stuff tennis balls. It appears back then, so much so that there was a royal decree at one point around, you know, what was sort of regulation stuffing for tennis balls and what was kind of outside the regulations. But it was, you know, it was what they had available, and it was as simple as having something to give the ball form. And there was no rubber, so it really didn't have much bounce to it.
Yeah, it sounds almost like you described sort of playing with one of these older style balls, and it doesn't seem to have moved very much at all once it hit the ground.
No, I spent time in Paris where I played on one of the oldest tennis courts in the world. It dates to the 1400s. And these courts, if you play on it, it really still looks like the cloisters of these monasteries. And the ball, all of the balls are handmade by the club pro at that particular court, really painstakingly. It takes like 20 minutes to create one ball, and they stuff it with wine cork. And when you play this game, you put a lot of spin on the ball, so it's a backspin kind of game, and it kills any bounce in the ball. The ball literally lands in the corner and just dies there. So I found it to be an incredibly challenging game to play because there's literally no bounce in the ball.
Hmm. And so how did it become a sport that that women also played?
Well, there's accounts of women playing early on. There's a wonderful account of a young woman named Margot, that's all we know about her, in the 1400s, who took on men across Paris, and she was playing with a hand, and they were playing with rackets, and she was beating them left, right, and center. So it was kind of way before Title IX, but she was showing what women were made of.
Billie Jean King would have loved her.
Billie Jean would have loved her, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Kindred spirits. But it seems to have been one of those games that, at least among the sort of aristocracy, it was acceptable for women to indulge in it, in part because it was not seen as a very physical game like football. Football was kind of the game of the people, or if you were an aristocrat, maybe of the peasants. Whereas tennis was this very erudite kind of intellectual pursuit.
The early iterations of football are so funny because, as today, there were a lot of brawls that broke out, and they would sort of tear up the towns where they were playing these things, to the extent that kings in France and England kept trying to ban it to no avail.
Yes, the game was notorious from the very beginning. That's why, when, you know, with all the discussion around violence in football today, I like to remind folks that, you know, it's kind of been part of the playbook from the beginning, and part of the thrill as well as the challenge of these games. But yeah, when you have 200 plus players and you have no rules to speak of and you have no boundaries to speak of, you've got people literally kind of running across the countryside or through the narrow streets of town, crashing around in pursuit of a ball. You can imagine that these games were fairly unruly. And didn't quite fit what the royalty had in mind for the people.
So tell us about Orkney.
Orkney's a small island off the north of Scotland, extends into the North Sea. And Orkney is one of these places where tradition continues long after it's died elsewhere. And I spent a very cold New Year's up there, looking at a game called the Kirkwall Ba, B-A, And the Kirkwall Ba is this extraordinary holdover of this this early form of mob football. And it's only played twice a year. It's played on Christmas Day and New Year's Day. So it's very kind of ceremonial, kind of a communal rite as much as a game. And it involves two sides of town playing against each other. So the one side of town is called the Uppies because they're from the upper side of town.
Mm-hmm.
The other side's called the Doonies because they're from the downward side of town. The ball is thrown into a large pack of players, no uniforms. You have to kind of know who's on your side. And for the next 5 or 6 hours, they crash around through town, through alleyways, nooks and crannies, trying to move the ball to their goal. So one of them has to move it uptown and touch it to a wall. The other team has to drop it in the sea at the port side. And, you know, other than that, there's really no rules. It's just knowing your team and it's sheer force and knowledge of the streets of town. And there's barricades on all the store windows to make sure that people don't go crashing through the windows. And it is one of the most thrilling sporting events I've ever seen.
What do you make of the legend that maybe the first time it was played, it was with a human skull?
Yeah, there is a wonderful legend of a tyrant named Tusker, who was reviled by everyone in the community across Orkney, and the story goes that that they got their revenge and they lopped off his head and then decided to play with it. I think there's probably vestiges of some past in that. I think when you look at this game, it's easy to imagine at one time there was some kind of conflict on this tiny island, maybe between one side of town, which would have been controlled by the bishop, and another side that would have been controlled by the earl. And to prevent violence, they created this game instead.
John Fox is with us. He's an anthropologist and author of the new book, The Ball, Discovering the Object of the Game. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is anthropologist and author John Fox. His new book is called The Ball, Discovering the Object of the Game. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. John, you call Abner Doubleday the mythological founder of baseball. We know that he existed, so what's mythological is his role in inventing this game.
Exactly. You know, we love to celebrate our founders in America, but unfortunately, Doubleday is not one of them. At least not when it comes to baseball. So, first of all, Abner Doubleday was a Civil War hero. So he was a historical figure who accomplished great things, but they were more with a rifle than with a baseball bat. The way the myth evolved really is. Baseball is a game that originated in England and has really evolved over time, really wasn't invented in one place. But in the 19th century, there was a desire to have a sort of simple answer. A guy named Al Spalding, who's familiar to all of us because we see his name on balls all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He was a famous baseball player, one of the great early pitchers. And because he started this sporting goods enterprise, he decided that that there should be a commission to investigate the origins of baseball. There had been lots of debate over where it had been invented first, who were the first players. He wanted to settle it once and for all and kind of put his name on it. And so he established a commission, And out of this commission came some evidence, and it was in the form of a letter. And this letter described how the great Abner Doubleday, the Civil War hero, who was known to all at that time, had instructed these boys in a small town, Cooperstown, New York, on the first rules of baseball, and scratched it in the dirt, and from that moment on, people began playing baseball. He thought that that was great, and he announced Abner Doubleday as the founder of baseball, and everything was settled, except it doesn't really add up.
So what do you think the real story is? What did you learn about the evolution and the different entities who contributed things to what the game is today?
Baseball's history is really fascinating, and there's a ton of debate. I mean, there's entire societies and conventions that gather to discuss and explore new findings, which crop up all the time. What we do know is that there were a collection of children's games that were played across England as early as the early 1700s. And the first mention of something called baseball is in an English children's book from 1744. And there's a woodcut of several boys in tri-cornered hats playing this game involving bases, no bat, again using their hand, and it describes the pleasures of baseball. So what seems to have been the case is that there were a lot of different games that involved base running, that involved, in some cases, hitting the ball with a stick and others not, and that these evolved over time into what we now know as baseball. But the first rules for baseball weren't codified until the 1840s, and so for 100 or so years, it was really this informal game played by children according to regional rules and local habits, and not this really formal sport as we think of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Back to the phones now. We'll speak with Josh in Richardson. Hi, Josh.
Howdy. I know that it's not your author's job to necessarily look forward rather than backward, and really, really interesting program, and I'm not even a sports person, and I find it fascinating. But I'm wondering, in his travels or his research, has he run across any sport or game that maybe at this point looks like the next soccer or the next big thing? Something that, I mean, we can't have invented all the ball games that are possible to invent. So I'm just wondering if you ran across anything else that looks like it has some possibilities.
That's a great question, Josh. I haven't seen or heard of any game that I think is going to take off on the scale of our sort of great kind of global sports today. What I do think is a big trend, obviously, is the sort of globalization, internationalization of basketball. We think of soccer as obviously our sort of global game, which it very much is. But basketball is raging right behind it. I mean, it is, if you look at the NBA and the makeup of the NBA, it's a surprisingly high percentage of players that come from outside the U.S. now, from small villages in Africa, from Eastern Europe, from Turkey. And it's hard to travel the world now in the most remote places and not see a basketball net. So I think you'll see the games we play today maybe spreading. I'm sure there'll be other games invented. There always are. But, you know, some of these games, these games have evolved over long periods of time and become really entrenched in these cultures, which is why they're so present. So it takes a really long time for a game to get traction.
Do you think games like basketball and soccer are especially likely to be global games because you need so little, there's so little investment in sort of starting up a team?
Definitely. And in fact, basketball is really the most recent of many of the kind of big sports we play today. It was invented in Springfield, Massachusetts by a guy named James Naismith. And one of the things he thought about when he was inventing the game was that he wanted specifically a game that would have a low threshold of entry. He wanted it to have simple rules. He wanted it to have simple equipment. So he didn't want a game that involved bats and gloves and all of that kind of equipment, but simply having a ball and a hoop to throw it into. So I think that's the case. I think these are games that anyone can play, that have swept the globe and are played in poor villages and are played in the most gleaming modern stadiums, and that's what makes them global.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Dennis on the line next in San Angelo. Hi, Dennis.
Hi there. I was wondering if the author has done any studying of the Gaelic ball games, like Gaelic football, or the most dangerous one, curling, which has some roots in Scotland as well, I believe. About 3,500 years or so years old.
Yeah, Dennis. In fact, I grew up, my parents were born in Ireland. I grew up surrounded by people playing Gaelic football and hurling, which are wonderful games. They can be pretty rough, but in a fun way. I did not include them in my book in great length. I talk about them a little bit, but absolutely. I mean, hurling is one of the oldest sports around. It, you know, it precedes the Romans and the British Isles, and it seems to relate to a number of other stick games, some of which evolved into modern-day hockey. There is a collection of games that were played with sticks that involved moving the ball on the ground, field hockey, what became ice hockey, hurling, and they seem to have pretty deep roots going way back.
I suppose it's not surprising, you know, we sort of laugh about soccer riots and things like that, but people have been fighting over, in other words, connecting with their teams even when they're not on the field for a long time.
Yeah, it's, you know, the whole hooliganism movement is an unfortunate byproduct of the passions that surround the games we play. I was just reading the other day about, you know, some of the behavior that goes on in Europe today, sort of racist driven riots and so on. The way I think of it is these sports are sort of magnets for people's passions. Sports have, in addition to being able to bring us together in community in a very positive way, they also have this capacity to divide us. And you know, we classify ourselves as, you know, with one town or another, one side or another. And, you know, in a healthy competitive environment, that's in good fun, and it's part of what makes the game great. But it can also be seized upon by elements who want to prey upon those differences and use them for their own ends, for violence and politics and what have you. And, you know, that's kind of the dark side of the game, too.
I did think it was remarkable reading in the book that some of the same effects on the brain itself, aside from the effects of the exercise, we get some of the same effects just watching a competition as we do participating in it.
Yes, there was a really interesting study done at the University of Rome that looked at what happens when people watch sports. And what they found is that there are these mirror neurons which fire when people are watching a game being played, which mirror the same neurons that would fire if you were playing it. So somebody watching somebody shooting a free throw, there are neurons that correspond to the pinky and the grasp that one has to have in releasing that ball. So what it shows is that, you know, our brains are literally in the game even when we're watching. There's about a 20% of the same neurons are firing when we're watching someone play a game. But that's, you know, there's still an 80% difference. You know, obviously playing a game not only engages us physically, but engages us, you know, 100%. Our brain is just 100% consumed by the action.
Did you learn anything about the bonding in sports between players that are on the same team?
I didn't explore it in any depth, but when I was in Orkney and I was in the middle of the Ba, Kirkwall Ba, it was one of the most striking components. I mean, these are men who have played together, you know, year in and year out. They have no uniforms on, but they have this kind of collective brain in a way, where they know the other players' capacities and limits so well that everyone plays their role in this kind of quiet understanding. There's a certain kind of psychology there, I think, that is not unique to sports, but is particularly present in sports, that ability to kind of connect up to a team in such a way that you become like a single organism.
There are some interesting new technologies out there that make it easier for us as spectators to follow the game and to really understand what's going on. Can you talk a little bit about some of those?
Well, there's a lot of work going on with kind of smart technology as it relates to sports. Some of it is putting GPS chips inside of footballs, so it takes the guesswork out of where the ball actually landed on the field. So it helps referees make the call. There's a lot of talk about putting similar technology within helmets to protect players or to be able to register concussions and sort of provide a quick diagnosis as they go along. I think what we're going to see is we're going to keep playing the games we play, but I think we're going to see an interesting merging of our sort of digital world and our physical world when it comes to sports. And it could be in a way that enhances the spectator experience of these games because it can connect you and make you feel more like you're on the field.
Did you have a favorite story of a particular sport that you didn't fully understand before you explored it for this book?
Absolutely. I would have to say for me it was lacrosse.
Mm-hmm.
Where I grew up, no one played lacrosse. I literally never heard of it until I was probably in college. And my son started playing it a few years ago, and I got intrigued and thought, wow, this is a physical sport, but it's got a lot of interesting strategy and these funny sticks. And spending time with the Onondaga Indians in upstate New York gave me a really deep appreciation for this game, both the game itself, because there's a lot of strategy involved, but it is a very, very physically demanding and aggressive game. It was a warrior's game for the Native American tribes, and you can see why when you watch it. But I also really came to appreciate it because I always thought of it as this, elite prep school game, and it didn't connect to my roots. But then when I realized that this is a game that goes much, much farther back and had so much meaning for the Native American tribes who played it, it just took on a new level of meaning for me.
Are tribal players bothered by the fact that it's now this prep school sport and that people don't necessarily associate it with their cultures to begin with?
No, I'd say they have mixed feelings about it. The Native American players that I spend time with took a great deal of pride in the fact that lacrosse is one of the fastest growing sports in the world. And, they just want the world to recognize that it began with them, just as anyone would. It's their heritage, and I think they feel very proud and happy to share that heritage with the world, but they want the recognition that, these great things came out of Native American tribes. And so with that is a lot of education. That's why they spend time with me, is they want to get their stories out and get their players more prominent and get their sport prominent as well.
The new book by anthropologist and author John Fox is called The Ball, Discovering the Object of the Game. John, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris. It was a lot of fun.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can send comments, questions, or suggestions about the show to think@kera.org. If you want to learn more or find out about upcoming programs, you can go online and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.